Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press. Our small press publishes books we want to see in the world, including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison of New World Witchery Podcast, and Verona Green, my latest book. Find out more about us and purchase these and other titles at thousandvoltpress.com. Benabel Wen is the author of I Ching, The Oracle, 2023, The Tao of Craft, 2016, and Holistic Tarot, 2015, published by North Atlantic Books. And she contributed to Llewellyn's complete book of North American folklore, Folk Magic. I always say it wrong. She is a Taiwanese-American occultist with deep family ties to Buddhism and Taoist mysticism. Wen has also practiced law in California and New York, primarily in the areas of venture capital, mergers and acquisitions, intellectual property, and securities law. Her academic background is in critical race theory and intersectional feminism, having focused her legal education in social justice law. Benabel Wen, welcome to Witchlit.
Hello, Victoria, fellow neighbor.
Yeah, it's so nice to have neighbor occult folks. I'm excited about this.
Yeah.
So our first question for everyone on the show in this age of, you know, TikTok and instant communication, why write? Why still write books?
Well, I guess that's a hard question if you're distinguishing it from social media, because I think both are the same, you know, to entertain or to educate. But I think with a book, it's something that a person can nurse in their own home. So it feels integrated into their everyday life. So something on my bookshelf is, it's a very different feeling. I have a different connection to that than something I'm reading off of social media. Mm-hmm. So to be able to have that connection with people, I think that's the reason to write books.
Yeah. Well, and I love the, I agree with you that I think you can learn from social media, and like it is that same level of entertainment. But I mean, for me, like the deep dive of a book is something that I feel like social media can't really capture. It's more intimate, it's more immediate. And then a book is something, like you said, that you kind of live with.
It's more bite-sized chunks, kind of like I think back in the older times when people, you know, would publish a book, like a novel, in chapters in a weekly newsletter or newspaper. Yeah. So I think blogs are sort of the 21st century equivalent of that, whereas the book is the entire novel or the entire subject matter. And mm-hmm. I think that's really important for a lot of people to have.
So you have done a lot of stuff. I mean, you're obviously a busy person. With three books, but the third book will be out this
September.
As we are talking in August, it comes out next month, it sounds like.
Yes.
Awesome. And, you know, obviously you have a full-time day job as a lawyer. So how do you balance all of that to have time to, you know, maintain this? If people haven't seen it, Benabel's website is a treasure trove of information. And, you know, have time to write and be creative with what most people would think is, you know, a life job that doesn't leave room for a lot of that.
A couple of things. One, you know, waking up earlier than everybody else, waking up, going to sleep later. So there's that aspect. But one thing I've learned from babysitting nieces and nephews is that I don't have children of my own. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part of it. Whenever I babysit for the weekend, cousins and sisters, it really is. They take up so much of your time and wonderfully so. But yeah, mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. And I think also just using my vacation time, you mm-hmm. know, to write instead of going off to exotic places. That's another little technique.
Mm-hmm. Or do you sometimes vacation and write somewhere else too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. There, for me, one of those things when I get stuck, I do not think I've actually had writer's block, but you do get stuck. And it's just a change of location can be great for your brain.
I find writer's block, I get more when I'm trying to write fiction. Mm-hmm. In terms of nonfiction, I don't get writer's block only in terms of when I'm trying to think of a subject for a book. So I kind of get stuck sometimes. What should I write for my next book? That's the writer's block I get. But once I figure out what I want to write in terms of nonfiction, it goes pretty quickly. And I don't get a block while writing nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Fiction, totally different world. I think I always get writer's block when I'm trying to write fiction.
And so I didn't know that you also wrote fiction. So what genre are you writing in?
Well, right now, I attempted to write fantasy, literary fiction, fantasy-ish, that or historical fantasy, that kind of a intersection. But like I said, writer's block means I don't have anything published in the realm of fiction.
Well, I will cheerlead you on because I am always happy to read new interesting fiction, and fantasy is my sweet spot. So
same.
So did you always want to write, or did that kind of come later? I mean, I know there's a lot of writing in law school too, in an academic way. So how did you evolve as a writer, I guess?
I think in fourth grade, Mr. Smith, we had a writing assignment. We had to write a short story. And I never felt like I was a strong writer. I also learned English as a second language. So it wasn't really until the third or fourth grade I felt like I had a stronger handle on the English language. Before that, I was in ESL. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Smith took me aside and said, "You're a fantastic writer. You're really good at writing." Now, whether or not he said that to every single kid or I was special, like that's a different story. I don't know. But at the time, I felt like he was only speaking to me. I felt very mm-hmm. special. And so that gave me the confidence to really pursue writing. And I thought, hey, Mr. Smith said I could do this. Maybe I can. You know, he wouldn't lie to me, right?
Right.
So I thought it was special. And since fourth grade, I've just really had this interest in writing and publishing my writing.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Yeah. It's amazing what a well-timed comment from a teacher can do for your writing confidence.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had Miss Lingerfeld in fifth grade. Same kind of experience. We had poetry assignments. So yeah, it had a little contest. So
that's how important teachers are. Everyone can remember the teacher's name, maybe just the last name, because mm-hmm. that's how we grew up. But yeah, we remember those teachers who have had an indelible influence on our life paths.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, I think if you are, I think anyone can write. I think there are certain people who are wired to want that and you know, express their creativity in that way. But it doesn't always get unlocked, right? Because you're either not given the opportunity or there's not someone like Mr. Smith or Miss Lingerfeld to go, "Hey, you're actually really good at this. You should, you know, pursue this." So I think it's, I don't know, it's just so important to have those people in your life, to have cheerleaders along the way, I think.
I might be more elitist than you are, because all I would say is read the comments section of anything on the internet. And suddenly you realize, no, not everybody can write.
They can write. They just might not do it well or get their point across clearly.
That's hilarious.
Or only be able to get their point across with 4-letter words.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, it is writing. Is it good? Maybe not, but it
sometimes
is writing.
It's very Dadaist. Like it gets very off the chart.
Very true. So I'm curious, I do want to talk about like your books and writing more, but I'm curious how, I mean, you work in Silicon Valley, basically as a lawyer, doing a lot of corporate stuff. So how do you balance like occultism with that reality? Like also living in Silicon Valley, it's not the most magical place.
It's hard. I think I still struggle with that, trying to compartmentalize the two, trying to feel out who you can talk to about what subjects. And so mm-hmm. I think it's still a constant struggle. It's a constant learning experience. I don't think I've really cracked the code on that. You know, and so, and even now, before I was in venture capital, which I actually think was more occult. I feel like when I was doing tech and VC work, mm-hmm. more people were more open-minded to the occult and the mm-hmm. esoterica. Now I've actually jumped ship. I'm now in health law. Mm-hmm. And so after I entered health law, you really don't see a whole lot of people who are as open-minded to mysticism or spirituality. Oh, so now it's even more closed off than before. At least in VC, you occasionally came across the witchy person or who wanted to at least in Silicon Valley, you know, Sage, the or Sage or Feng Shui, their offices.
Interesting. I mean, I think, you know, as an outsider, you would think there would be more mystical people like in health than in venture capitalism. I mean, that it does seem kind of surprising.
Yeah, I know.
But I don't know. There's, I'm always, and you probably have this experience too. Like, it's always funny to me when you run across someone who's clearly a little witchy or a cult in a setting where you totally did not expect it at all. And it makes me just wonder, like, how many more people are out there who are just under the radar? I mean, because not everyone is public, has a book published, has a podcast. You know, there's a lot of people who just live their lives. They're a little occult. Little is not even the right word. They're occult lives, very much under the radar. So
there's little code words, right? So sometimes people use, they'll just drop in the word casually during conversation in corporate, mandala. Or they'll say, right? Or they'll say manifestation. And then you have to clear, oh, is this person more new agey or is this person more occult, witchy? And that's an interesting conversation too. But yeah, there's little code words that people just casually drop into corporate conversation that will give it away. Or they say Venus retrograde. They go, oh, you know something.
You know that's something. Yeah. It's, yeah, the little, like, it is like a secret handshake code word. I like that.
Yes, it really is.
So I have not gotten to take a look at the new I Ching book, but I want to give you an opportunity to talk about it because you have that coming out, and then you also contributed to the Llewellyn Folk Magic book. So the I Ching seems like a huge thing to tackle. I mean, I know enough to be dangerous. Let me put it that way. I'm not.
Awesome. You know,
but
that was very corporate speak of you, by the way.
Oh,
right. Don't they say that in corporate? I know enough to be dangerous. I'm like, wow. Yeah. Every time someone says that, I'm going to take a drink, take a shot.
Yeah, it's like your own corporate bingo.
It is. Yeah.
But like, what was the impetus? I mean, you talked about like kind of having a little bit of writer's block around what to write next. So what was the decision like to tackle that?
I translated the I Ching from the classical Chinese to English a long time ago, over a decade ago. And then I simmered over it because, oh, this is really funny. I was under the impression that there was this Confucius said axiom out there that you don't really understand the I Ching until over 40. And so I thought, well, who am I to try to publish or write about or teach anybody anything about the I Ching until over the age of 40? And then after I hit that slump of over 40, then I was like, okay, now let me sit down and do the research. And funny enough, when I sat down to start fact-checking and doing the real serious research for the book, that never happened. Confucius never said that. It was never, it's not a thing. It was just fake news. Yeah, it's kind of funny. And so I'm like, well, all right. He said something different about that. You know, he said something about over 40 is when you start self-reflection or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I realized, oh, okay. But then that's kind of the impetus of writing it. It was the book I've always wanted to tackle. I think in Chinese academia, there is this idea over the dynasties and centuries that to be an elite scholar, you need to have interpreted and have your commentary on the I Ching. It was that important to Chinese scholarship for so many dynasties. It was just something, it was on my to-do list, my bucket list of things to do.
Oh, cool. Yeah, because it seems from the outside, it feels a little daunting to tackle something like that. But I love that it became like this decade-long project in its own way, too. So I also got to dip into the Tao of Craft, which, because you have some lovely excerpts on your website. Thank you for that, for podcasters who are stalking their hosts, stalking their guests. That's really helpful. Because I also, and Marcus, bless him, your PR person at Llewellyn sent me the Folk Magic book. So I got to read that section too. But I love how you take what I think for some people, like outside, like, Taoist mysticism and Buddhism concepts that could be, I mean, they're obviously new concepts because Eastern thought on occultism and Western thought on occultism are different. You take what I think are complex things and break them down really well to kind of just, you know, introduce someone who may be completely unfamiliar with, you know, like the different element system and the dual nature of Taoism and all of those things. You break it down really well to give people a foundation to look at these things coming to it. And do you, for you, like in writing these things, like what do you hope people come away from it? Because I assume most of your audience are coming from a Western lens. You're publishing in the US, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only the Western lens, but I think there's many different audience, like subsets of audience groups. And another one would be Asian Americans. A lot mm-hmm. of Asian Americans, they lose their connection to the motherland, the ancestral connection, where if you don't speak, read, and write Chinese, a lot of our culture will be inaccessible if you can't read and write Chinese. Mm-hmm. And so that was on my, you know, in the forefront of my mind as well when I'm writing is to think about, you know, the little sister or the little brother who mm-hmm. who doesn't have access to the language, whereas I do. Well, how do I be that bridge, that translator, that mediator to help with that? And also, I think you do see mysticism talked about and is compared to something in the Western modality. Especially Christianity, you know, previous translations of the I Ching have always been filtered through the lens of Christianity and at best Christian mysticism or Rosicrucianism. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to unfilter it and show how it is through the more traditional classical Eastern perspective is something mm-hmm. that mattered a lot to me. And then yeah. knowing that somebody might not have that cultural background means you do have to break it down to the bare essentials. And so that's mm-hmm. something I try very hard to do to yeah. make it easy and accessible.
Yeah. I mean, you succeed. It was just, like I said, you know, I have a couple friends who are very into the I Ching. And so I, you know, they have like thrown sticks for me and done stuff, but also, you know, coming from a Western perspective on it. And I'm like, okay, I really want to get this book now and take a deep dive because it's, I don't know, intellectual magpie. B, like, I just really enjoyed your writing. It's just so clear and directive without being like authoritarian, I guess, maybe is a way to describe it.
Well, I'm so glad. That's, you know, that's what every writer wants to hear. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. So for the folk magic book, like what was working on that project like? Because I know we talked a little bit before, listeners don't get to hear the pre-chat. But you also know Corey pretty well. So how did working on the North American Folk Magic book, how was that process?
It was really fun. Corey reached out to me and asked if I would be interested in contributing a small piece to this greater anthology of looking at various traditions of folk magic across the Americas, or I think it was specifically just the United States or North America. I can't remember exactly.
I think it's North America.
Oh, North America. Yeah. Perfect. And so he said, oh, would you be interested in writing something about, you know, Taoist magic or Taoist mysticism and what Chinese practice in Chinatown, because we do have a lot of Chinatowns in the along the Pacific coast. I said, yeah, absolutely. And so it was more memoir like. I think that mm-hmm. writing that chapter was pretty easy because it was just about reflecting on my experiences and my observations as being mm-hmm. part of the Chinatown communities here.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting in looking at the book. I don't know if you've had a chance to kind of leaf through the whole thing. But, you know, I think Corey breaks it down into like the Pacific, Northern Pacific coast. So it's like kind of from about where we are in the Bay Area up through the coast of British Columbia. And like there are three authors and like some of the other sections have like five and six authors. And even though like, you know, California has the largest population, I feel like it's, you know, magic in the U.S., occult thought in the U.S. tends to be very East Coast in some ways, even though you think of California as like this new agey paradise, a lot of like occult thought, a lot of occult writers, there's obviously the, you know, epicenter of Salem and all of that on the East Coast.
Wow, same exact words. I was going to say Salem is the epicenter. That's why.
Yeah. So having been in New York and having been on the West Coast, like how do you see those different, I guess, communities of occult practitioners and magicians and witches? And
well, one thing that might be different for me is when I lived on the East Coast, I lived in upstate New York, a small suburban town. And so you really didn't see as much of East Asian mysticism among Asian communities because one, either it was Christian and they were Christian Asians, or two, they were trying so hard to assimilate that you just didn't see that as much. It was kind of subdued. Whereas on the West Coast, I think they have a much more vibrant history and legacy of the Asian American diaspora. And so there is more unabashed open practices of the folk religions. And so that's a big difference.
Yeah. And that makes sense too. Yeah. Just having more cultural context to be in than in, like you said, like a tiny town in upstate New York. Yeah. I know it's been interesting for me. I mean, having come from a flyover state, I guess Tennessee is still considered a flyover state, although Nashville likes to think of itself as the third coast these days. and then moving to California, it was refreshing how open people can be here about most things. Like people really just kind of leave you to be yourself in a way. I mean, you know, whatever people may think about California from the outside, there are paradisical things about it. It is not 100% a liberal paradise, but, yeah, it's just been nice to just kind of be like, whatever you are, it's fine kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I have heard that, Californians, we're nice, but we're not kind. Have you heard that before? We're other parts of the world.
Yeah. I've heard people say that. But funnily enough, I would say that about Southerners a little bit too. I mean, Southerners can be kind, but there is a politeness that can be shallow in the South.
Bless your heart.
Yeah. Bless your heart is a perfect example. Yeah. So it's not completely, that part wasn't as surprising to me, I think, but we moved originally into like a really big apartment complex, and like I never met any of my neighbors. Like everybody was just kind of in their bubble. Like kind of reminded me of the few times I've been to New York, like people just don't engage. But when we moved to a neighborhood in San Jose, like our neighbors immediately talk to us and we meet people when we're outside every day, you know, like it's a totally different vibe. So, but I think it was just that the apartment complex we're in it was in Santa Clara. So it's like a lot of tech workers, a lot of transient, like I'm here for a few months and I'm going somewhere else after this. And so I think people just don't engage locally around them. So it's easier just to keep to yourself.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's still, I mean, California is definitely grown on me. Like I mean, it's hard not to love that the weather is always beautiful, except when, you know, it's flooding or on fire. So
in California, I always think I'm a transplant from New York, but then when I visit upstate New York, when I go back home, I realize, oh my gosh, I'm very California now. You don't realize how much you've acculturated to the state until you leave the state.
Yeah. Did you grow up in New York or did you grow up here?
Oh, I grew up in upstate New York. So I didn't come out to California until law school. And then, you know, after you graduate, you look for a job. And I just found a job here and I just stayed ever since.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's, it's funny. Like, I feel like I have met a handful of people who are actually from here. Like, it's also one of those places where a lot of people are from somewhere else.
That's true.
So for you, to kind of rerail us, I guess, onto writing, although I love the rabbit holes too. So what does your next project look like? I mean, how, obviously the I Ching book is coming out now. So you've kind of been done with your part of that and getting kind of ramping up for marketing and all of that. So what does starting a new project look like for you? Like what research and, you know, how do you approach something like that?
I think I'm probably a slower writer than most. It took me, 9 years to write 3 books. So, with that rate, I'm probably not going to come out with another book for another 3 years. So I guess the process is a lot of simmering because I think I want to be very intentional and thoughtful about what my next project is and will it contribute to the greater discourse of that subject matter. And so I do take a long time to figure out what the next project is. I think like a lot of writers, you have a whole bunch of half-baked manuscripts somewhere on a hard drive. And so I do have a bunch of half-baked manuscripts, one fiction that I keep telling myself I'll finish, but it hasn't been finished for the last 25 years. You know, I've gone through so many cycles and manuscripts of that. So at some point, I would like to publish fiction just because that sort of was my original and first love. In terms of a next project, I don't know. I think I'm still simmering over that.
What it's going to look like.
Yeah.
Do you find, like, once you have your target, I guess your target's topic, do you spend a lot of time researching, or do you kind of dive in and research as you go, as you're writing?
I dive into the research. I probably accumulate research and file it and organize it and work through just research without that much writing. And the only writing I'm doing is note-taking for about a year before I actually start any writing at all in terms of the chapters of the actual book. And so, but then once I start writing the book itself, it goes fairly quickly because I've been simmering for a year. And basically I have a table of contents fleshed out before I even sit down to actually begin the writing process. So if you have that table, basically it's like an outline. So if you already know exactly where you're going and you have well-organized, well-tabbed research for every chapter in that book, it goes fairly quickly once I figure out exactly what I want to do.
Have you found like kind of in your occult writing that having this academic writing, like in law, and was that helpful to kind of make that leap? Because you kind of have structures in place around like how you did research and note taking and all of that.
Blessing and a curse. I think it's a double-edged sword, right? Mm-hmm. So what you just said absolutely is the blessing part, where you have a discipline and structure around how to tackle research. I published in peer-reviewed law journals prior to writing Holistic Tarot, my first book in 2015. And so the positive side is that rigor around research and having that academic training. The negative is the academic training. So trying to strip away some of the way you speak and the language is something that I had. It was a journey for me as well. The citations, for example, the funny thing is because I come from law, all my citations in the beginning were in Blue Book. Blue Book is the citation format that lawyers use. And so, which is completely foreign to in the, you know, liberal arts, humanities, psychology, you know, spaces, MLA or APA. So switching over from Blue Book to APA was another leap.
Yeah, I did my master's degree in English. So MLA was the one. And I'm currently working on a nonfiction project now. And I find that it is difficult to not oversight. Like everything I say, I feel like I need a citation for, because I'm like, oh, I'm making this pronouncement. And I'm like, well, sometimes it's just my thought. I don't have to cite that. I don't have to tell me. I don't have to tell where that came from.
The academic training that you have, you know, we have, it is, if it's not your original thought, you need to cite it. Mm-hmm. And then when you're doing a nonfiction research, you're like, well, none of these are my original thoughts. So you do have a propensity to oversight.
Yeah, I think it's, and I think that, you know, it's been from what you said earlier, I'm going to assume you're over 40. So, but I do think there's also that, like, coming from the, you know, taking notes on everything and kind of this approach to heavily cited occult books has kind of been a more recent thing. Like when we started in occultism, at least when I started in more Western occultism, when Scott Cunningham books, there was a bibliography at the end, but there were no citations. So I think it's, you know, it's come from like the expectation that this book is coming to you like a grimoire that has been copied down and, oh, here's some influences on it, to, oh no, we're going to cite everything. And there's going to be a bibliography and further reading and all of that at the end. It's kind of been interesting to watch this cycle of the expectations of occult books, I guess.
Yeah, I think in 2015, when I sat down to write Holistic Tarot, prior to Holistic Tarot, I didn't see that many books in tarot spaces and witchcraft communities where you did have heavy citations. But then I think as by the 2020s, you started seeing a lot more books being heavily cited. I think before there was this acceptance of I channeled the book and that was enough. That was enough authority that you channeled the book, or you were a priest or priestess and that was plenty authority. I think now we have this new expectation, even in our occult spaces, that you should have citations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder, like, I feel like we're in this, I guess I'm of two minds in a weird way, because it's how my brain works. Too much Libra in my chart, I guess.
Oh, same.
Yeah. I have a lot of Libra in my chart. Like, I love the rigor of that kind of academization. That's not really a word. But we'll make one up.
It is today.
It is today of kind of occult writing, because I want to know where stuff is so I can go look at what they looked at. Like, I love that part of it. But there's also this tiny part of me that feels like it's also like this deep need to still validate and legitimize personal practice. And so it's, it's kind of like you said, it's a blessing and a curse, double-edged sword. Like, I think it's really good, and especially for book nerds, to have that opportunity to go, okay, so this is what they're saying. I really want to go look at the source of that or read that and, flog through a Gerald Gardner book, whatever, your particular way to geek out about the occult is. And then I'm also like, are we still trying to prove that we have a right to be accepted as valid?
Yeah, I think that's a tough one, because we do, so many of us have that hang up, that's like inner psychological hang up, that you do feel like you have to overcompensate and prove that what you're doing is valid. And so a lot of us oversight, especially if you have academic training, you want to apply that academic training in a really over heavy-handed way to prove that you're valid. And that's unfortunate too. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, I don't, and that's why I said I'm in two minds, because I don't want to come down on anybody either way they fall on this scale. Like, if you, like, because I've read, recent books where people really are talking about their personal gnosis, and there is no need for them to cite that. They're telling you, this is my personal gnosis. And those books aren't heavily cited. And I think those are completely valid and very rigorously cited, more academic leaning books are also completely valid and useful. So I don't really have a judgment on it. I just find it an interesting dichotomy to live with, I guess.
Because if you look at established traditions, religions, they don't feel this weird need to cite everything, like Christianity, even Buddhism. A lot of it is personal gnosis. This is my experience with Jesus, and they don't feel the need to oversight. So why do we have this weird compulsion to oversight?
Yeah. And I don't know if it does come from having academic training or the sense of validity, but I think there is, there's still like a skeptic in me about like, is this really real? Am I, what is it? Is it spicy psychology? I don't know. And then part of me is like, does it matter if it works?
Agreed.
Yeah. If it's just me convincing myself this is real, then it's real. Right. I mean, my brain can't distinguish between that and, it actually being real.
It plays devil's advocate. I wonder if it's also because we've had so many decades of books where without citations, it's, this is my personal gnosis. However, the way it is written and presented is, you need to do it this way too. This is the one and only right way, because I am an authority, because I have a direct channel to whatever gods or goddesses. And so I think because of the phrasing over the decades, now there is this need to kind of counterbalance that. And so it's saying, well, it's in this source, do with it as you will, because it's just, it's not my words. It's here, words are over here. Mm-hmm. You can modify and work with it as it, as you will. So I think maybe it's just sort of a pushback to the long standing tradition of, this is my personal gnosis. However, you must accept it. This is the only right way.
You have to do it this way. Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. Not a devil's advocate point, just a good point. that, And I do wonder, like, one of the interesting things about being doing the podcast or reading a lot of new books that are coming out is I feel like they're past, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, when everyone was desperately trying to prove that we weren't all a bunch of Satan worshipers. And so there was this real push to say, oh, no, this is, you know, a peaceful nature religion, you know, paganism. And
you don't do curses.
Yeah. Like, and to now, like, people, the Wiccans, everybody, like, really this kind of return to interest in grimoire, historical, you know, ceremonial magic, all of those things, this kind of turn of the wheel to this new paradigm where people are like, oh yeah, I want to go read grimoires. There's all this academic work around grimoires, and realizing, oh yeah, some of this stuff is kind of gross and brutal, but can I take something from this thing that obviously it is not going to work in modern practice and make it my own? And I think you're right about that. I think there is this, like, oh no, I'm going to figure this out for me from this historical source, and then I'm going to tell you what worked for me.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that in so much of what's published now, that that's kind of the spin on it. It's like, oh yeah, here's the historical thing. I'm not going to, you know, murder a cat. I'm not going to do these things. Here's how I'm going to do this working with my substitutions.
That was something I had to really think about when I was writing Dao of Craft on food talismans. There's a, even today, to this day, present day, a very vibrant aspect of the practice is you consume the talisman. So you know, you paint it, you craft your talisman, and then you eat it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to go write this in a book and have people think that this, you know, you have to balance that. Like, there's mm-hmm. the tradition, and then what do you, in a very practical way, say mm-hmm. to people in the 21st century, and also avoid liability. You don't want right. liability on you either. And so I'm like, oh, these are really interesting mm-hmm. things that you have to think very seriously about if you're going to write in this space.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have noticed that, like, all newly published occult books have a disclaimer.
Yeah.
In them somewhere. It's either at the front or it's in the introduction. There's always a disclaimer. Which I think is, you know, like you said, is kind of necessary. And it's interesting that about eating the food talismans, because, I mean, there's a lot of grimoiric stuff where you write something on a glass plate or a tile and wash it and drink the water in a lot of grimoiric work. So it's interesting to me that, you know, there are these things that kind of overlap in Eastern and Western occult stuff that, you know, arise in their own context, but have similar effects and meanings. So I feel like there's like 1,000 questions I want to ask you, like really specific. And I'm like, I'm trying to keep it more on the thing. But one of the things I thought about that was interesting about the food talisman work, especially on the website, you kind of talk about cultural appropriation and how to approach these things kind of outside that. And so I kind of wanted to ask you if you wanted to talk about like your perspective on that. And
yeah,
it's a hot topic, obviously, but I think an important one too.
I'm still trying to process that. I think on a very fundamental core truth level, culture is not something biological. Culture is learned, it's socialized. And I think to say that somebody needs to show me their DNA results to practice something, I don't know how I feel about that. And also, mm-hmm. I think every culture and the relationship between two different cultures is so important before you think about the concept of cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. And so I think specific, and I can only speak to Taoism and Buddhism, right. In terms of East Asia and their relationship to a lot of Western societies in the Americas, Europe, Britain, Great Britain, and so on, it's complicated, right? You know, you have imperialism. You have that post-imperialistic mm-hmm. mindset that some Asians are still processing. So when they say, oh, I still want to keep certain practices closed because mm-hmm. I have this internalized pain from, you know, people telling me I have to be Christian or trying to Christianize my folk practice. I get that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. For me, I like to be more open about it and say, I have enough confidence and faith in the practice itself for attaining its purity, no matter what other people want to do to it. And so I mm-hmm. think there's space for both. There's space for progressive, integrative, syncretized practices. Taoism itself is syncretized. You know, you see so many different influences from other cultures and traditions and religions. And so by its very nature, it's different from other religions. Taoism is syncretic by its nature, and therefore it should continue to be syncretic. Mm-hmm. And so I want to see that. But then I just hope that there are a couple of pillars who continue to maintain and preserve the more ethnic oriented tradition. Mm-hmm. So both. I don't think I have. Yeah, I don't want to, say anybody should not practice something because of who they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's this kind of like, I want to be careful about where I tread personally, right? And I feel like for me, there's a difference between like studying something outside of my culture because I want to know about it and understand it. And then there's also that's one way to approach things. And there's also, I want to understand it enough maybe to incorporate some of that into my practice. And then the line for me then becomes, I'm going to teach other people how to do this thing. I'm going to somehow benefit financially from this. And to me, that's like a hard no. Like that is the line you cannot cross.
Oh, interesting.
But I think, it's really difficult for me to say, I'm not going to tell anybody what to do when they're alone. Like that's not my, who am I to tell them what to do? But
have a different perspective, at least specific to Taoist yeah. mystical practices, Taoist magic and Taoist traditions, and also esoteric Buddhism. My perspective is if you've done the homework, if you've done the work and you've studied it and you really are an expert or you're very knowledgeable because you've done the work, you have to then balance that with the reality that we live in a capitalistic world. Mm-hmm. And so because we live in a capitalistic world, globally speaking, culture gets commodified. That's just yeah. sort of the reality. And so to pick and choose what can be commodified, I don't feel as great about that. I think if you have done the homework and you are yeah. learned in that area, mm-hmm. because we are a commodified society, I'm more open-minded and okay with that.
Yeah.
Specifically
Taoist
magic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, like not, well, and I feel like there's been, this is like, again, my very armchair amateur thoughts on this. I feel like there's Buddhism has been, it was introduced to the West a while ago. Like this is not a new introduction, but there's also this kind of Western approach to Buddhism that is just like, it's just a way to be mindful. The kind of the mysticism is stripped from it. Like we've also stripped mysticism from Christianity. I mean, so it's not surprising to me that that's kind of the interface with some Western traditions. But I feel like you said, that there are closed esoteric practices that are not for everyone for whatever reason, whatever the reasons that people have for that. Like, I feel really strongly about respecting. And then, there's also, the part of me who's like, we're all living on this tiny marble in space. And then we've set up these artificial things between us. And I'm like, are there but, again, it's back to that. Is it real or not? It is artificial, but it has real world impacts and conflict arise from it. So it's a weird soup of things to think about, I guess.
I think that's why it is such a difficult and complex issue to parse through. And I think the only way to really begin to have meaningful conversations around that or meaningful conclusions is you have to start by looking at the geopolitical relationship and history mm. between the two cultures that are being interfaced.
Yeah.
So before borrowing from a particular culture, reflect on what is the history between those mm-hmm. two cultures and what is the reason some people in that tradition are saying, or a lot of voices in that tradition are saying, this is closed or this is not closed. Like, where is that coming from? And I think that's the first place. That's where you would want to begin the conversation.
Yeah. No, I think that's good advice for folks. And I think it's just, at this point, I don't know, like you and I could have this great conversation about it. You and I can go have this conversation with other people. I think it's just going to continue like that. I don't know that we're going to solve this problem
Oh, no, no. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we can solve that, we can probably solve world peace.
Yeah, really. let's get the occult community on that.
Yeah.
Snap. If we can solve our own inner conflicts, we can we can export out. Yeah, no, I would that would be lovely, wouldn't it? So like I said, I try to keep us to an hour, but I'm so enjoying this conversation. But I just wanted to ask if there was anything in particular like you wanted to talk about or address, or like in your writing, in your books, in your work, like was there anything in particular you wanted to talk about?
Ooh, I hadn't thought. What's your thought or perspective on, I guess we'll just use the word Western. What's the Western perspective on Buddhist and Taoist magic?
I think for me personally, and this is one of those things I think I can only speak for me personally, like I'm fascinated by how many public occult people have trained in some form of Eastern mysticism as well as, you know, being like Western esoteric thought and practice, or, you know, grimoire magic from Europe, or, you know, folk magic from whatever culture they're from. And then also this, and I don't know, I do think there is both the intellectual magpie approach to think, like, I think once you start to study something, you want to see the breadth of it, right? If that's how you look at the world, you want to see, well, if we think this way, what, you know, what is the Taoist or the Hindu, or, you know, what is the other perspective on this? So I'm fascinated by it. And I think that it's really interesting to me that there seems to be more like open communication about, oh yes, I've also studied, you know, either like kind of the mystical aspects of a martial art or a Eastern philosophical tradition. Instead of just kind of, I think the early days of occultism in the, you know, the United States were like, we just wholesale are going to borrow everything we can from everyone who's here, and we're going to make it ours, and then we're going to package it and sell it in plastic. And so I really appreciate this kind of intellectual academic pursuit, but also just like the, how does this impact my practice directly? Because I don't think you can live in a multicultural society and not be impacted by that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been part of Western occult traditions for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Even when you look at how invested Crowley was in East Asian traditions, he writes very extensively about the I Ching and Taoist magic, and he even integrated hexagrams into his tarot. Mm-hmm. I think Gerald Gardner traveled through East Asia and Southeast Asia, I believe, for a while.
Yeah.
And so, and Clymer as well, it's been so heavily, Alphys Levy, I remember just the fun of going through certain Western occult books and then just randomly coming across conversations about the I Ching or the trigrams. And I'm just like, what? Or Fuji, various mythologies that's related to Taoist mysticism. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's actually been integrated into Western esoteric thought for much longer than we realize.
Yeah.
And it's because there was this whole period where, like you said, there was a whole period where we didn't cite our sources. And so you didn't know what was coming from where.
Yeah.
But if you can go before that, if you move earlier than that period of time, you do find a lot of crossover and syncretization. And so even between Christianity and Buddhism, like if you look at Orthodox Christianity, a lot of the Christian stories come from Buddhist legend, and a lot of Buddhist mythology comes from Greek mythology. For example, I think was a Vajrapani, or there's a couple of gods that the way we talk about it, it's actually based on Hercules.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, I do think there is this modern glitch that we have that somehow the ancient world and the pre-colonial world, people just never traveled or they never went anywhere else. But there were huge interchanges culturally between, you know, if you think about like the Silk Road and like trade routes and all of that stuff. And the first series I wrote, fiction series I wrote, was set in Slovenia. And it was kind of this crossroads of Europe. You know, it was on the edge of the Ottoman Empire. It was part of the Habsburg Empire. you know, is where those cultures met. And, you know, they were, you know, there's Roman settlements. Romans brought Greek gods to them. You know, then there's Christianity laid over that and Slavic folk magic. And it's just like these excavatable layers of things that kind of produce modern thought, right? And that's true everywhere to some extent.
Manichaeism was huge in both Europe and China for the longest time throughout the medieval period in both parts of the world, which was this syncretization of Christianity, Islam, Zoroastrianism, Buddhism, Hinduism, like all these religions, and they just mix it all together. Mm-hmm. And this was a religion you found temples and books and texts and and practitioners, both in Europe and in China. And those archaeological records exist to this day. I don't know what happened. Somehow it just kind of went extinct before we entered the 18th or 19th century. But yeah, it was so big in both parts of the world for a very long time and hated by all of the Orthodox traditions. So Buddhism did not like Manichaeism. Christianity and Judaism did not like Manichaeism. But it was just this really interesting sort of, you know, counterculture at the time, counterculture religion that was actually very robust and popular.
I mean, and I think there is, you know, I think there is a tendency in humans to want to see how we're the same, right? Like that universalist impulse to say, oh, you know, we all get to the same idea somehow. I'm like, you know, to some extent there's some truth to that. But how we get to that idea is really what makes a culture, right? So it's interesting to me that it's always been the case, even though we have this idea that everything we do is new. Like, it's really not.
And to that, I would say it's the thought process. I think like the thought process is what distinguishes between, I guess, appropriation, which is something that we're talking about, versus like maybe appreciation. Mm-hmm. I think there is something about our love, a universal agape love, that motivates us to want to find the common denominator across many different religions, because religion is so personal for people. Right. And so if you can appreciate somebody's religion, you will appreciate them as a person. Yeah. And so I think if you can find that universal common denominator in various traditions and then accept that on, you know, on for what it is, that breeds appreciation. I think sometimes where people get in trouble is when they say, oh, they're similar, therefore they are just like us. And so, for example, for a long time, it was, oh, there's these elements of Confucianism or Taoism or Buddhism that's very similar to Christianity, therefore it's Christian, or I can Christianize whatever that was that I was looking at. And then you cherry pick and you dispose of what is not Christian, or you dispose of what doesn't fit into your filter. And so that's when you get into dangerous territory. And I think that's a good place to begin the, you know, assessment process.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point to make, because I think it really is, you know, part of appropriation to me is taking something out of context, right?
Yeah.
Like that's really when you get into trouble. It's like you either see that similarity or you see the shiny of it. Uh-huh. And then you're like, oh, I want this thing without understanding, you know, the development of it, the history of it. I think that's why, again, you know, kind of to go back to the Tao of Craft, is that I felt like you did such a good job of grounding. It's like, yes, you can learn about this and you can incorporate it in your practice and you'll figure out how to do that. I mean, you say in the introduction, you know, part of this is to give you the foundation to see how this would work for you, but to really understand where it comes from first. And that to me is like at the root of it, I guess. It's like, just really understand, try as much as you can as an outsider to really have a true understanding, or as much of an understanding as you can of the outsider, before you say, oh, I'm just going to pluck this one element and move it over here.
I think that's what inspires me to write the type of books I've been writing, both the Tao of Craft and the I Ching book. Is so, you know, my perspective, my philosophy is I do want a more universalist approach to these practices, where I want you to find what in this works for you. But then how do I do that for an English speaking audience, but then also arm them with the knowledge and the historical and cultural context, so they can actually be very competent when they have conversations about this. So nobody ever accuses them of appropriation because they're armed with the knowledge. Yeah. And so that's a strong motivator and driver of how I write my books.
Oh, I love that. I think that's a good place for us to move to our second and third segment, I guess. Before we get to our game of chance question, with Dai, not Hexagram or I Ching. Would you like to let folks know, like, where to find you, like, what's coming up? Talk a little bit about, you know, any events or anything. This will actually air at the end of November, so we've got a little bit of a gap before it comes out.
Well, then I Ching the Oracle, my third book, will be out by then. I hope you will go take a look at that and get that. And if you are interested in what I've been eating, my social media, Instagram, is my everyday life. It's not very deep, not very educational, but, you know, it's fun. And so Instagram at Bellwin is a good place to find me for the everyday. And then if you want more educational deep dive resources, things to download, references, materials, BennaBellwin.com.
Yeah. And I will say again for listeners, do not sleep on Bennabelle's website. It is amazing. There's so much information there. I'm so excited about all the tarot stuff. That's been one of my projects this year is to, I've always been an oracle card reader and to really kind of get more into the tarot and kind of the history of it. So I was so excited to find all the stuff on your website about that. So our last question for our guests is a little bit of a game of chance. I will roll a die. And I joke that this comes from my Scorpio nature, but also I think it's also writer brain to talk about the things we're not supposed to talk about. So depending on what number I get, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want. And this game has very few rules. So if you get a question you don't want, you can skip and we'll get another one. So
sounds fun.
Three, religion. Funny, because I feel like we talked about that a lot. I think one of the things that's been interesting to me in Western cultism is it a practice or is it a religion? So how do you think about your cult work? Is it a practice or is it a religion?
I refer to what I do as religion, and it's religious because you can't prove it with science. A lot of it is a leap of faith, because if I'm using systematic language, I can't really explain a lot of what I'm doing or what I believe or my philosophy. So I do call it a religion, but it's both. I mean, the reason we have this difficult controversial conversation is because I do think witchcraft and occult practices, it's a practice, right? Mm-hmm. I think most people who identify as occultists or any derivative of that title, you're not just reading books, then you're an academic, you're not just reading, you're doing yeah. something, right? And so it's a practice. And I think religious practice, often it's just prayer or just some kind of a, you know, like it's just an invocation of deity. But I think an occultist doesn't just invoke deity. And so that's why I think it is a practice. It's that really weird gray area. Mm-hmm. But I would identify as, I would identify what I do as religiosity.
Yeah. No, I like that approach. Yeah. Well, and I also feel like because of the culture we live in, there are benefits to thinking about it as a religion, because then you have, ideally, I will say ideally, you have some protection under the law, right? If it's religion rather than just something you do on a Tuesday night. So I think that, you know, there are benefits to that, but it can also, you know, thinking of it as a religion in those terms, for some people, I think it changes it. Like, you know, they either have a really negative experience with the religion of their family or that they grew up in. And so calling, you know, this thing that they have found that is now theirs, their occultism, whatever that looks like, a religion, is traumatizing, because they don't want that overlay of authority that I think religion carries with it. So
that's true. I always joke about that. Like witchcraft for me, I'm going to argue it is a religion when you start threatening it, because mm-hmm. that you do have that like real life legal protection. And so right. that's when you start making that very strong argument. It's a religion. Everyone get behind you. It's a religion. We're all nodding our heads. It's a religion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then when you're in safe space, like, well, is it really a religion?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, again, it's kind of like the appropriation conversation. Like it's an ongoing conversation, right? Like we're still figuring these things out. And I've talked about this on the podcast before, and listeners will probably be like, this is your hobby horse, Victoria. But but we're still new, like not as much Eastern occultism, obviously it's been around a lot longer, but Western occultism is still relatively fresh. Mm-hmm. And especially kind of, if you think about like the neo-paganism revival since the 40s, 50s, it's, you know, we're still getting our feet under us. We're still in the myth-making phase. You know, all of those things are still new and amorphous. And to say there's like the occult community is sometimes even facetious, because there's a lot of people who don't consider themselves standing under that same umbrella with you. So.
And I think we operate under different definitions, and then it's very difficult. I mean, even just going back to religion versus practice. So for example, if I want to clear the air in my house and I cut an onion and leave, you know, a cut onion out, or I have garlic out, is that religion? Like, is that religious practice? Or is it just, like, it's so hard to make, to categorize some of these more specific practices. Feng shui. Mm-hmm. Is feng shui a form of witchcraft? Is it religious practice? Or is it just a I don't even know what you would call something like feng shui, right? Mm-hmm. Where you believe putting, you know, how you arrange furniture in your house or how things are arranged, directionality. How is that witchcraft, or is that religion, or is that, what is that, right? And so I think we have very difficult conversations as well, because even what is a witch? Who can self-identify as an occultist? And even what is atheism? For example, like atheist witch, Christian witch, there's all of these words that people, we don't even all have the same understanding of what these words imply or these titles imply.
Yeah. I think what is a witch is one of those. I just finished last night listening to the BBC Witch podcast, mm-hmm. which I will highly recommend to podcast people. It's really well done, and it's a great exploration of what the witch means. And again, there's no definition that you can come to when you're talking about witchcraft or a witch in the modern sense. I mean, there are some historical definitions of witch that aren't particularly flattering, but I don't think you can come down and say, this is what a witch looks like in 2023. There's no way to do that.
Even what is magic, what is folk mm-hmm. magic is up for debate.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I mean, and, you know, perhaps because of my nature as a writer and just a human, like, I kind of like that we're in the soup about it. I kind of like that there's no hard and fast. This is what you must do. This is what you must be. Like, I like that it's amorphous, but I could see how that's frustrating for people looking at it from outside. So. Awesome. Any last thoughts, Benabelle?
I had a very wonderful time speaking with you.
Oh, thank you. Me too. I love this. I like that we're literally practically neighbors.
I know. We're going to have to do something about that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing your work with the world. I mean, I think, you know, it, though we live in a capitalist society, to sit down and write a book is really a gift too. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Victoria.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Sue Fertal edits our transcripts, which are available with all of our previous episodes at witchlitpod.com. You can follow us on Instagram and Threads at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.